Times in our lives when we tend to believe that something that is what appears to be a physical only condition doesn't have any psychological impact. And that is by no means the case. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and delighted to welcome also Dr. Grace Mucci and Dr. Jonathan Romaine, both of whom are neuropsychologists. Welcome, doctors, to Mind Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Now, Dr. Mucci, I'm going to ask you to explain to our listeners what it means that you are a neuropsychologist. What is your particular area of expertise?
Okay. A neuropsychologist is a specialist in the observation and understanding of brain and behavior relationships. So we are actually psychologists, clinical psychologists by training, and then we receive specialty training in addition to that in neuropsychology. And both Dr. Romaine and I have also received additional specialty in pediatric neuropsychology. So helping children who have some kind of neurological disorder, certainly epilepsy is one of the more common conditions that we work with, but also other kinds of disorders that affect cognition and behavior, such as traumatic brain injury or certain cancers and other neurological disorders. So, and we work either primarily doing evaluations to understand what's going on with that particular individual with regards to their injuries or their illness and how that might translate or affect their day-to-day functioning in not only cognition, but also psychological functioning and just day-to-day quality of life.
Now, this is a question to you both, but I'm going to ask Dr. Romaine to pick it up initially. When one hears things like epilepsy, traumatic brain injury, and pediatrics, you know, it brings up a lot of stuff, right? Because you don't want to think about a child as having anything but fun and no worries in their lives. But when we hear the addition of epilepsy, for example, and that's what we're really going to be focusing on today, it brings up a lot of fear in the hearts of many parents, and certainly for those folks who are adults who are dealing with epilepsy, many times it brings up a lot of fear in the people around them. I say that all to say there are lots of myths about epilepsy. Dr. Romaine, would you talk a bit, and then of course Dr. Mucci, I'd like for you to chime in as you would, just about what exactly epilepsy is and who it affects.
So epilepsy is a neurological disorder, and it's a disorder of electrical activity. The way it was described to me years ago, a good example is if you think of like a stadium and, you know, like say a dome. In a dome stadium, before the game starts playing, you have a bunch of people who are getting in their seats, and there's a lot of noise and a lot of chatter in a lot of different areas, and it's just kind of general noise. And then what a seizure is kind of when you have kind of maybe the whole section starts to do a chant, and they all kind of work in succession, and then that translates to the rest of the stadium. That's essentially what a seizure is. So it's a neurological impulses that are abnormal or aberrant, and they kind of perpetuate and propagate on their own, and that develops into a seizure. So that's essentially what epilepsy is.
Is it true that more children than adults have epilepsy, and can you grow out of it?
Oh, I think that's a fantastic question. I can't tell you what the statistics are with regard to children versus adults, but what I can say is epilepsy often does arise in childhood, and there are certain types of epilepsy. So I counsel parents that epilepsy is kind of like a snowflake. I mean, every I mean, there are certain categories of types of epilepsy, you know, Dravet syndrome or Landau-Kleffner or something along those lines. But even within that, it's kind of like a snowflake. So some individuals will grow out of epilepsy depending on the type of epilepsy they have, and other people, it can be a lifelong issue for them, either, you know, controlled by medication or sometimes, unfortunately, not well controlled by medication.
So, Dr. Mucci, is there a way to determine, as you are evaluating an individual, whether or not their particular experience of epilepsy is lifelong or perhaps somewhat time limited? Is there a way to know?
I am not aware of any test or any tool that a neuropsychologist has to determine that. I think, like Dr. Romaine says, it's very complex. There's lots of different syndromes, lots of different types of epilepsy, some that arise in childhood at certain ages, some that are not considered to be as impactful in the sense of its impact on cognition or quality of life. Others that are have much more of an impact on development and interrupting those stages of development. And there's also certain epilepsies that might develop in adulthood that are very different than pediatric onset. So there's so many factors that go into it, and I am not aware. That would be a great question for a neurologist to find out if somebody does have epilepsy, that they would ask their neurologist, you know, is this something that is going to either impact my life, you know, my cognitive functioning or my psychological functioning, or is this something that if it's well controlled with medication, then I can pretty much lead a relatively normal life? That's a tough question. I don't think we can truly answer that.
So at this point, folks who are listening are hearing epilepsy and a couple of significant maybes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many parents that if there's something that's going on with their child, they assume that it is their fault, that they somehow made this happen. Can you speak to that concern that parents may have?
So, I mean, epilepsy is a neurological disorder. There are many different etiologies. I don't think parenting is one of them. I think what makes epilepsy so much challenging too is that it's a neurological disorder that does often have behavioral manifestations. So sometimes people might think that it's kind of a voluntary thing that's going on, or kind of entirely stress mediated. And so you see these an individual engaging in a behavior that is abnormal, and we often think that behaviors are within our control. So thus, the behavior that the person's doing when they're having a seizure is something that's under their control, but that's really not the case. So essentially, what I would say to these families is that, you know, this is a neurological disorder, like many neurological disorders, and it is not directly caused by environmental factors. Mm-hmm.
So bad parenting is not going to make your child more susceptible to epilepsy.
I can't imagine how that would happen.
No.
The good news, again, is that I think because we have so many different ways of thinking about parenting and the impact of parents on children, that for our listeners to know that if your child has a neurological issue, it's not your fault. Because, you know, so many times when you get caught up in whose fault it is, then it kind of takes you away from what's emotionally going on for me and for my loved one, and what emotionally can we all do to deal with whatever this issue is. Fault and blame and shame really get in the way of so much.
Absolutely. And I know this discussion today is on epilepsy, but I would also think that this is in an appropriate or important topic to discuss with autism spectrum disorder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In terms of epilepsy for the moment, what in general would you say is a sort of overall psychological impact on the child and on the family when they receive this diagnosis?
Oh, that's a great question. So When a child receives a diagnosis of epilepsy, certainly that has repercussions not only with the child, but also with the family, and it can also impact close friends and extended family members. So there's a lot of factors that go into how well a child can adjust to that, but their initial reaction is usually shock. Just like any kind of new medical issue that somebody's facing, they kind of have shock. They don't know what this is. A lot of times they haven't even heard of it or don't even know that this could possibly happen to them, don't think that it could. So it's usually shock, and then there's a period of, let's gather as much information as we can about this so that we understand more. Sometimes a little bit of denial enters into this equation. That's perfectly normal, but we want to make sure that we help families and children who are going through this process of coming to terms with what they have been diagnosed with, because denial, while it's very common and sometimes adaptive and helpful in certain situations, with epilepsy, you don't want, denial to take, a strong hold, because it can affect your medication compliance, which can ultimately affect seizure control and then ultimately affect future development. So there are a lot of things that we need to be very mindful of as healthcare professionals and mental health professionals, that we, especially people who are working with children and adults with epilepsy, that we make sure that they're taking their medication and that we are also addressing what does this mean in their day-to-day life? How are they able to, are they able to still go about their day-to-day functioning with minimal disruptions? And if not, then we need to work at trying to minimize those disruptions as much as possible.
Dr. Romaine, it certainly, it is true, as Dr. Mucci just indicated, that if a parent in particular is steeped in his or her own denial experience, it could result in, not my child, so medication is not necessary. It could result in so many things. What are some of the things, in addition to, if there are any, in addition to what Dr. Mucci has indicated, that you're likely to see in the parents of the child? Any other emotional reactions?
Well, I think just to echo on what Dr. Mucci had said just a second ago, with regard to, well, there's obviously the denial piece, but also we see that epilepsy is portrayed in many different ways in the media, and in movies and entertainment, and there could be family members, and there's also a stigma associated with epilepsy, certainly in a lot of cultures. And so I guess just one piece that I wanted to add to Dr. Mucci's great response is that that every child is different. Every epilepsy is different. Every seizure disorder is going to present a little bit differently. And so don't just assume that if a child's been diagnosed with epilepsy, it's going to be the most catastrophic version of epilepsy or something that's portrayed on the media or in the media.
So perhaps the good news is that while there are so many variations, there's also so much help and awareness that you really can think more narrowly about your particular situation with yourself or your particular loved one, rather than this is something so huge that cannot be managed and I just want to go to sleep and ignore it.
Absolutely. And every situation is unique. And that's why, fortunately, we have a lot of teams of providers that work with the family and work with the child. It's usually, especially when we have our more serious epilepsies or epilepsies that are not controlled by medication, there's an entire epilepsy team that's kind of working alongside the family and the child to kind of help them navigate this complex neurological disorder.
Speaking of teams, the two of you work as a team within an organization. Can you tell us a little bit about where you folks are working and the overall approach to this treatment?
So there are different centers, and people might know this of for epilepsy care. There's different levels, I should say. So level one through level four epilepsy centers. Level one and two epilepsy centers are essentially working within the emergency department and primary care doctors who are familiar with epilepsy. Individuals who have epilepsy that is well controlled by medication can usually be monitored by primary care and neurologists within the community. It's those individuals who are intractable, meaning that they have persistent seizures despite medication and other interventions, that require increased level of care, and that level of care is in those level three and level four epilepsy centers. The CHOP Children's Hospital is designated a level four epilepsy center, and what that means is it includes a team that can provide evaluation, that can provide long-term or video EEG monitoring as needed. It can do invasive monitoring, neurosurgical intervention, and also includes neuropsychology. So it's a full spectrum of care for epilepsy patients.
And when you say CHOC, what does that stand for?
Oh, sorry. It's Children's Hospital of Orange County. We go by CHOC Children's.
Okay.
CHOC Children's.
And there are a couple
in California.
I was about to say there are a couple of Orange counties that exist. So which one are you?
You know, so we are Children's Hospital of Orange County, California, CHOC Children's.
Got that. All right. Dr. Mucci, and again, Dr. Romaine, please join in this conversation or this question as you like. I wonder, though, what it's like for you as clinicians working with children, working in a level four facility, where I would think that not only is there so much to think about in terms of the physicality of the illness, but also the emotionality of the illness on the individuals and loved ones. What's it like for you as a human being just to work in that environment day to day?
That's a great question. So, wow. So as a clinician, you know, I feel it's an extreme privilege, basically, to work not only at CHOC, but also with families who are experiencing many times such difficult situations and emotionally challenging situations. So I actually, in addition to evaluations, I do a little bit of therapy, psychotherapy for children and families as well, to help them navigate, you know, whatever challenges they're facing with their illness. So it is, it can be very difficult sometimes. So the good news is, and I don't know if you've ever, I'm sure you have, you've heard of the compassion fatigue.
Yes.
That mental health professionals and medical professionals, for that matter, anybody who's in the helping professions, you know, sometimes, you know, we can't just leave our job at 5 o'clock and go home and not worry about things, because we do care for our patients and our clients, and we do grow quite fond of them. And so it can be very difficult as a clinician, and self-care is very, it's very high up there on the priority scale. Things like meditation and exercise, getting enough sleep, eating right, those are all things that as providers we need to do to take care of ourselves. And frankly, the patients need to do too. And so imparting those strategies and lifestyle needs onto our patients is so important. And if we're not doing it ourselves, it's kind of hard to tell our patients to do that. So I try to walk the walk, and that's kind of how I deal with it.
Dr. Romaine, anything you'd like to add very quickly before we go to break?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as I said earlier, that we have a team to help our families and help our patients, but I think the team also helps each other.
Mm.
We have our epilepsy surgery conferences where we meet as an entire team of, 10 to 12 white coats sitting in a room kind of discussing patient care. And so it really is kind of almost like a village, so to speak. And I think it's helpful, yes, obviously for families and for parents, but also for individuals and clinicians. I also like to add that many of us working in epilepsy centers and children's hospitals, we don't tend to shy away from challenges. And, you know, when I see that there that a child is really struggling and there's a difficult case, this is kind of almost the end of the line. This is where a child has failed multiple medications, is having recurrent seizures, is at risk for having greater problems, and someone needs to take care of these mm-hmm. kids and these families, and I consider it a privilege to be able to be part of the team.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I want to just echo that as well. I think the privilege of working with such talented professionals who deeply care for their patients beyond what I think people really can see. But I do know that all of the colleagues that I work with and all the physicians that I work with, neurologists and nurse practitioners, they care very deeply about their patients. And as a team, we do support each other in those times when we need it most.
Dr. Mucci and Dr. Romain, both pediatric neuropsychologists, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to begin with talking about some of the specific behavioral issues that can show up in persons with epilepsy. So folks, don't go away. We'll be back in a second. What would you say are some of the behavioral issues that can arise for someone dealing with epilepsy?
Okay, there's several different things that could arise. I think some of the more common ones are things like depression and anxiety, also attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or ADHD can be a common comorbid diagnosis. In some situations, you might have maybe some psychotic symptoms as well that need to be addressed, and I guess some oppositionality and or some aggression that also can manifest. But those are not as common as things like depression, anxiety, and attention problems. Those are the most common.
Dr. Romain?
And I would say... Yes, I would say that a lot of the behavioral issues that you see with children with epilepsy are the behavioral issues that you see with children who don't have epilepsy and children who just have, say, again, Dr. Mucci talked about some of the other kind of associated with their. So behavior is a manifestation of something else. So if one has ADHD, you're going to see more impulsivity and less thinking before doing and distractibility. And if you have depression, you might see more withdrawal and you might see less involvement in activities. And with anxiety, you might see some impulsivity as well, but also those outward behaviors of anxiety. So a lot of times it depends on what is driving the behavior that is going to dictate what the behavior is going to look like. And by and large, at the end of the day, a lot of the behaviors we see, behavioral issues in children with epilepsy, are very similar to the behavioral issues that we see in our quote-unquote neurotypical children.
Dr. Mucci, you used two words that I just want you to explain to the audience who may not be clear. Comorbid, that's kind of scary if you don't know what that means, and psychotic.
Okay, yeah,
so what does comorbid mean?
So basically comorbid, it means that it's something that occurs in conjunction with something else. So for example, let's just take depression or symptoms of depression with children with epilepsy. Their symptoms of depression, it's a very high comorbidity, meaning that we see it a little bit more frequently in children with epilepsy than in children who don't have epilepsy. So okay. That would be what we call comorbid. Sorry about that.
That's okay. And psychotic, what does that mean?
So psychotic, so this is symptoms of psychosis are things like maybe some delusions. They might have some feelings that somebody's following them, or maybe they have some, they might hear some things that are being said to them that other people can't hear, or see things that other people can't see. Some of that is actually or could be related to the underlying seizures that might be affecting certain parts of the brain that give rise to those kinds of symptoms. So, like, for example, children who have seizures that occur in the temporal lobe or also in the occipital lobe, they may have some symptoms of hallucinations that might just be indicating that there's a seizure happening. So,
for a parent, let's say a parent hasn't had a diagnosis, is there of epilepsy for their child. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to look at the behavior and say, maybe I should get more information? I ask that in the context of so many of the things that you both are talking about, depression, anxiety, in adolescence, in children in adolescence, they're kind of often there, and one doesn't necessarily equal the other, I guess is what I'm saying. So how does a parent know what to do and when to reach out for help?
Oh, that's a great question, and good to clarify. So, just because a child is anxious or has some kind of depression doesn't mean that they have epilepsy. I think there are other symptoms that could indicate that there might be something else going on that needs some medical attention or at least additional evaluation by a medical specialist. So if they're having, like, there's a certain type of epilepsy that's called absence epilepsy, and typically a lot of times it looks like they're just not paying attention. They have little periods of brief inattentiveness that, when you snap your fingers and they'll come out of it and, oh, okay, what were you saying? So now that could just be simple attention problems, but it can also indicate that maybe there's something going on, is neurologically that needs to be followed up. So I would just encourage parents, if they have any concerns, to take their child to their pediatrician and get a full evaluation. And if they see things that are out of the ordinary, jot it down, keep a log of these things. And when they go to their pediatrician, they'll be able to show that to them and have a recording or a better recollection of the things that they're concerned about. I don't know if that answers.
It does. And the other piece, though, I'd just like to throw in is that illicit drugs can bring about some of the behaviors that you're identifying. So again, I think it's really important for a parent to not say, oh no, not my child, but to reach out for some help.
Right.
Absolutely.
You've both talked about the impact of epilepsy on cognition. Dr. Romaine, can you say more about that?
So the impact, epilepsy is a neurological disorder. So we see children who have cardiac issues or skeletal issues or diseases or disorders that affect other parts of the body. But epilepsy is a neurological disorder. So that's going to be affecting the brain. The disorder affects the organ that's responsible for thinking, learning, processing, managing emotions, and those kinds of things. So it makes sense, and it's predicted that we can see some difficulties with cognition or thinking and learning and processing. Cognition is just a fancy word for thinking. So you can see areas of attention being affected. You can see memory being affected. Certainly, depending on the type of epilepsy or where the seizures might be occurring from, There are different regions of the brain that are, in theory, responsible for certain neurological activities or cognitive activities. So if a particular part of the brain, say, for example, I say left temporal lobe or the temporal lobe, temporal lobe epilepsy is fairly common. If the temporal lobe is responsible for memory and consolidation of memory, so if that area is being affected, then you might have memory problems. But in general, when we do our neuropsychological evaluation, when a child has epilepsy, it's usually kind of, I call it the kitchen sink evaluation. We essentially assess all aspects of thinking, learning, and processing because you never really know where the breakdown might be. If someone has a memory problem, it could actually not be a memory problem, but more of an attention problem. They're staring off and they're not paying attention. So when you give them multi-step commands and they only do one or two of them, is it a memory problem or is it again because they weren't paying attention? So it's important when we deal with kids with epilepsy that, you know, to know that this is a neurological disorder affecting the brain that is responsible for all aspects of thinking, learning, and processing.
So this is not necessarily a child who's just being oppositional.
Absolutely not.
And you know, again, I think it can't be said often enough. There are so many things that behaviors could indicate that it's never a good thing to decide that you've seen these three behaviors and therefore they mean this, and then you as a parent decide that you're going to treat this the way that you think is the most appropriate way to treat it. That's actually never a good idea.
No, absolutely. And oftentimes, you know, when in a level four epilepsy center, we're seeing kids who have, you know, a long history of epilepsy. They've been evaluated. The kind of the front line has already been established. These are kids, we know they have epilepsy. Usually, though, when you're working with a primary care doctor or neurologist, they're going to be including an EEG. And an EEG is an electroencephalogram, which actually measures brain waves from the skull, from electrodes that are attached with sticky tape, essentially, to the skull. And that's the best way of discerning whether someone has a seizure disorder or epilepsy. And so if you look at the definition of a seizure is a behavioral or a cognitive or some other type of expression or presentation in the context of a change in the patient's EEG. That is the definition of a seizure.
Mm-hmm. Is there a time, Dr. Mucci, when one can say, well, I'm this age and I haven't had a seizure, so I'm good. I don't have to worry about epilepsy.
Well, that's an interesting question. So my initial thought was teenagers. So teenagers, a lot of times, especially if they've been dealing with this, they've had to take medication. I mean, I deal with kids that, you know, they're distressed. They don't want to take this medication anymore. It can affect how they feel in certain situations or in certain ways, and they don't like it. They don't like the side effects. And so they think, I haven't had a seizure for a while, so I don't really need to take it. So a lot of times, if they express those concerns to their neurologist, a lot of times we'll get that referral. Like, you need to meet with little Janie to tell her that this is not a choice, unfortunately. And so we do deal with that. And, you know, like Dr. Romaine said, this is a neurological disorder, and medication is the primary treatment for epilepsy, and it's a necessary treatment. It is not something that they could just decide they don't want to take. In fact, they have to be very consistent with their medication. They really can't miss doses. And usually children understand that at a certain point, but when they become teenagers, that's a risk. That's a time where it's very it's possible that they're going to say, you know what, I haven't had a seizure for a long time. I don't really need this medication. And what happens, unfortunately, is probably they will actually have a breakthrough seizure. And that could make it, you know, difficult to bounce back from that. And so we want to try to nip that in the bud and not let that happen. But teens are very unique because they are facing a lot of independence needs. They want to be independent, make their own choices, And there's also the other issues of abusing or experimenting with other drugs or alcohol. And, you know, how do they reveal their epilepsy to their friends? There's all kinds of unique risks in adolescence that we are very mindful of.
So I'm looking for you to give me the magic number that says if you haven't had a seizure by X, you're home free. And I'm not hearing that magic number.
You know, that's a really complicated thing, and I do want Dr. Romaine to chime in on here too, but I think it really depends on the type of epilepsy or type of seizures that a child has. There are certain types of seizures that after a certain period of time, then they can talk with their neurologist about maybe starting to wean them off of the medication to see if they don't need it anymore. And I think it just really depends. I don't want to say a number. Maybe Dr. Romaine is more comfortable doing that. I don't think he is either. But there are some epilepsies where they're going to need to be on medication for life. That's the reality of the situation.
All right. I think this idea of a magic number is just not happening, huh? Not going to give it to me.
I think it's a kind of percentage base. It's percentage of risk. So risk goes down depending on the type of epilepsy that one has, depending on how much medication they may need, depending on a variety of different factors. And so I don't think most epileptologists or neurologists would give an absolute, but when they and the family and everyone feels comfortable, they can talk about weaning off the medication. But I've heard situations where very conservative neurologists, because again, I think this is a decision that needs to be made individually with the neurologist, the patient, and the family in mind. But I've worked with some neurologists where they're very conservative and they like to keep kids on medication for what others might say is a longer period of time. And lo and behold, the child gets off the medication and they have a seizure within the next, with the subsequent 2 or 3 months. And what we really want to prevent is we want to prevent seizures, because actually seizures beget seizures. When one has a seizure, there's a greater likelihood that they will have future seizures because the way the brain is affected, the way the neurons are affected. So we don't want to kindle, is what we call, kindle or cause increased potential for having seizures. So that's why a lot of neurologists tend to be very conservative. And it's not going to be black or white. It's a percentage, and it's a percentage of risk.
Aren't there particular side effects that one would anticipate when someone is on an anti-seizure medication?
That's another great question. These are very complicated medications. I would say to most of my families, well, obviously you want to talk with your neurologist and epileptologist about the specifics regarding the medication that they're considering. But usually we kind of group the medications in terms of activating medications and medications that kind of deactivate or kind of slow neuron processing down. And so there are some notorious medications for causing or accentuating behavioral issues in children. And there's other medications that are notorious for causing problems with, say, word finding or cognitive slowing or slow processing speed. So it really depends. And to add further complexity to the question of the situation is a lot of children, especially when they're in a level 3 or level 4 epilepsy center, they're on multiple medications or what we call combination therapy. So in fact, they're taking several medications that have unique interactions between and amongst themselves.
We know that with a lot of folks who have ADHD, self-medication is, you know, drugs, alcohol is often an issue. Is self-medicating often an issue with folks with epilepsy or no?
So are you, if you're referring to the, if somebody has epilepsy and then they also drink alcohol and or smoke marijuana or do something like that in conjunction with their epilepsy and taking anti-epileptic drugs, the answer is that would be a problem. Because a lot of these drugs, number one, you have anti-epileptic drugs when there's a lot of interactions with alcohol, with and we don't really understand the interactions with marijuana at this point. There's a lot of studies that are looking at that right now, but you know, that's a huge risk factor because it can, alcohol can really alter the way medications either, they can either enhance the effect of the medications or they can hamper the effects of the medication. So it raises the risk of them having seizures, additional seizures, and that's a problem. I'm sure Dr. Romaine can chime in too. So.
Well, I would just say in my experience that most people who use substances are trying to alleviate a particular symptom. So it may not be the epilepsy or the seizure itself. And in fact, many times individuals who have had a seizure or who have seizures lose consciousness as part of their seizure. So they actually have no recollection of having the seizure. And there's some children that I've worked with who really have never experienced the seizure themselves because they've lost consciousness at the beginning or the outset of that seizure. So I would think that the more of the substance abuse issues come from managing the secondary symptoms, which include depression, anxiety, and ADHD, and we all know how well that works.
Yeah, exactly. Folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. Dr. Mucci, in your work as a neuropsychologist, I understand that you're also taking a look at the long-term neurocognitive effects of cancer. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is.
And Dr. Romaine, I understand that you, in addition to working with epilepsy, you're also doing work with traumatic brain injury, concussions, and high-functioning autism. Is that accurate?
Yes, I co-direct the concussion clinic with one of our neurologists here at the Children's Hospital.
So I bring that out to say that clearly we are just touching the tip of the iceberg in terms of the expertise that the two of you bring to these areas. So needless to say, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask if you would be willing to come back and talk to us about these other issues.
Absolutely.
See,
love
I gave you enough time to say, of course I would. let me ask you this. So many times when people hear that someone is an epileptic, they get scared. They don't want to hire them. They don't want to talk to them. They don't want to be in a relationship with them. What can you say about that sort of social reaction to the fact of epilepsy?
Oh, so that just breaks my heart when I hear these things and when I hear the amount of stigma that children and adults with epilepsy experience on a day-to-day basis and myths about, you know, their condition and how that affects their ability to be productive and be able to contribute to society and so forth. So it just breaks my heart. And I think that there's some good things happening that are increasing society's awareness of epilepsy and the needs of this community, and also just how incredibly wonderful these individuals are and how much they have to offer. So one of the things that the Epilepsy Foundation is one of the major organizations in the United States that is dedicated to increasing awareness about epilepsy and addressing some of these myths that people carry with them because they just don't have an understanding of what it is and how individuals with epilepsy, you know, are able to hold down meaningful employment and do the things that people without epilepsy are able to do. So I don't know if that addresses your question, but I'm hopeful that, you know, as we increase our awareness about epilepsy, that those reactions from people who really don't have all the information they need, that will lessen as we increase our awareness. And just an aside, November is Epilepsy Awareness Month. So usually that's a time when there's a lot of activities going on. They have walks, they have events to help increase this awareness in our community. So, and we participate in that in a number of ways. So it's a big issue.
I mentioned before our epilepsy center and the amazing team of physicians and providers that we have, including the neurologists and radiologists and neurosurgeons. But I also really want to add the within the community, our epilepsy support networks are so important. Mm-hmm. And they work for educating the community. They work for educating parents. They work to provide collaboration amongst providers and parents and children. We also have support groups. We have social groups and other opportunities so that these children don't feel alone. We can't be responsible for everyone's behavior. So you never know when you're going to get into a situation where someone might say something that's negative, or a child with epilepsy might be put in a bad situation. But at least if they have the support in place, they're less likely to feel stigmatized, alone, and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. A question to both of you.
Can I just add one more thing to that?
Absolutely.
This does underscore the importance of support groups for parents, because they unfortunately get a lot of questions and looks and, when they're out in the community, and misunderstandings from others. And that's where a support group comes in. It's so valuable for not only the kiddo and the individual with epilepsy, but for their family members, because it's only in those kinds of support groups that they feel like, number one, they're not alone, and number two, they have some tools that they can use to educate people in the community when questions arise.
I'm so pleased that you're emphasizing the value of support groups, because it's just not clear to me that enough people really understand how empowering and helpful and educational and everything else support groups can actually be.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And I think it's true for just about any illness, any condition that you have. If you are with other people that have a similar experience, you'll never meet somebody who has the same experience, but you'll at least have somebody with you that has a similar experience, and that you have this shared experience, and it's extremely powerful. So you're absolutely right.
When an adult has been diagnosed with epilepsy, do you recommend that he or she disclose that to the employer before an interview, during an interview, after an interview, or never?
That is a great question. Wow. So, there are certain laws that protect individuals with epilepsy and other disorders and issues. So I've actually worked with some young adults who this question has come up. So I think I can answer that. It really depends on a few things. It depends on the nature of the job. And it depends on the relationship they have with their potential employer. Do they have a previous relationship with them through some other channel? Is this a totally new person? But in general, I would say my instinct is to say, this is not something that you want to disclose out on the outset in an interview. You do your interview, And then if they make the job offer, then that's a time that you can decide, is this something that I want to disclose to my employer or my potential employer if I accept this job or not? And I think a number of factors can go into that. Number one, how frequent are their seizures? Do they occur during the day or just at night? Are they going to have to be absent a lot to go to medical appointments? There's a lot of factors that would go into that decision, but my intuition says probably not at the interview, maybe at the job offer, and there might come a time when they are working that they will have to disclose that to their employer. And the good news is there are laws that protect discrimination against somebody with them, you know, something like epilepsy.
For parents whose child has been diagnosed with epilepsy, should they disclose this to the school?
I think that's a great question. I think that oftentimes when a child has epilepsy or seizure disorder, it can affect thinking, learning, and processing. Again, it's a neurological disorder, so it's affecting the brain that's responsible for those processes. So there is a strong likelihood that there'll be some learning challenges. So part of special education support, if that's something that's needed, or accommodations, usually it stems from a medical diagnosis or a specific learning disability diagnosis. So sometimes it's actually beneficial to, I would say in many cases, it's beneficial to have a discussion with the school. It's not so much to say, hey, my child has epilepsy, although I think if a child has uncontrolled epilepsy and certainly daytime epilepsy or daytime seizures, it's important for the nursing staff to be aware of that. Oftentimes these kids also need medications possibly during the day. So I do think it's important to have that piece of disclosure. But going back to my other point was, we can often see learning difficulties in children with epilepsy. So I think it's important to sit down with school and have a discussion about, the learning struggles that may be associated with the child's epilepsy and kind of developing a plan for that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think about the child who has epilepsy, also has some cognitive challenges, may in fact be in special ed, and we live in a world where that's such a double, triple whammy, if you will, for that child to deal with. What about bullying of children with epilepsy? Do you have any information about that?
I don't have any specific information. I do know that children, medically fragile children, and that would include children with epilepsy, that's the term we use, that they are at risk for bullying, and it happens unfortunately, at rates that I would not like to see. I wish it was zero, but bullying can happen, especially if the child has a seizure and the children see that, and they might, there might be a bully that teases them or what have you. So, and I've seen that. I've dealt with children who have experienced that. So it's, unfortunately, it's not uncommon. It's something that needs to be dealt with rather quickly. It needs to be dealt with from a kind of more of a systemic approach. So that would involve the principal, the teacher, the parents of the other children. It just needs to really be nipped in the bud. And that's why sometimes, back to the earlier question about should a parent disclose to their school about their child's epilepsy, in most situations it is helpful, because then you can garner the support of the teachers and the aides on the playground and so forth to be mindful and to be watchful of what's going on with their child to ensure that they're safe out on the playground and then also in the classroom. And it's a good idea to include everybody in their educational team to deal with that bully situation.
Going back to the other piece with regard to special education, I do think special education largely has come a long way, in the sense that I think many children with special education needs who are identified as having difficulties, there's kind of more of that seamless seamless support. So it might be a small group instruction or some type of pullout or something along those lines. So I'm hopeful that it's no longer a special education, you're completely in a different classroom. Obviously, it depends on the child's unique needs, but there is that least restrictive environment mindset within the public schools. And we, as neuropsychologists, as part of our evaluation, we help the epilepsy team to monitor the progress of the epilepsy. We help be part of the epilepsy surgery decisions that are sometimes considered. But we also work closely with the parents and with the schools to develop a report that includes recommendations to seamlessly integrate pieces of special education within the child's general curriculum.
Mm-hmm. For the parent or the adult who has epilepsy and doesn't have insurance, what do they do?
Mm. Oh, boy. Let's see. I don't know. Do you want to tackle this one first?
That's a fantastic question. I think it's somewhat state-dependent. We have the fortune of working exclusively with children and young adults, and there is, state insurance for those, for kiddos who have complex medical issues.
Mm-hmm.
So there typically is an insurance for those children who have degree of medical need. And I will say that the access for individuals or for children who, don't have the resources otherwise are just as wide open as the child who has private insurance, certainly in our hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have a supplemental insurance plan in California that covers medically fragile children. And so we don't really run into that problem too much. I'm sure there are other sections of the country that this is a problem, though, and I would say that if they don't have insurance and they're having trouble getting medical care or medication for their condition, then they should probably contact the local Epilepsy Foundation. I'm sure there's some programs that they might be aware of that they could tap into that might help cover some of the costs of their medications, but they obviously do need to receive medical care, and I would hope that there would be some support in some fashion for everyone who needs it.
That's a great recommendation to contact their local epilepsy organization. Dr. Mucci and Dr. Romaine, there's so much more to talk about and so little time left. Would you give us information or contact information? Where can we learn more about what you are doing, about CHOC? Help us out.
Okay. Well, CHOC has a website. It's www.chock.org. So that's probably the best way to see what we're doing here. I'm trying to think of other resources for us. Dr. Romaine?
Again, we work intimately with the Epilepsy Support Network of Orange County. I'm sure in wherever anyone's listening, their particular county will have an adjacent county, hopefully, would have an epilepsy support network for them.
Right.
Wonderful.
And there's a lot of other organizations that I would turn parents to. One really good website for parents with children with learning issues is understood.org. And I just find this website. It came up about 2 years ago, and it's my go-to site now. It's fabulous, and I would just encourage parents to go to that. It covers everything pretty much, ADHD, depression, anxiety.
Oh, that's wonderful.
IEPs, everything.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Awesome.
Folks, thank you very much both. Dr. Grace Mucci, Dr. Jonathan Romaine, thank you both for joining us today, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again real soon.
Great. Thank you so much for having us. We really enjoyed it.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I think it's been so informative. So, on behalf of everyone listening, thank you for the work that you do.
We appreciate that. Thank you. And
folks,
thanks for all you do.
Thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. which is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available on demand daily by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play stores. And folks, I'd love to know where you are right now as you're listening to Mind Talk. So send an email to me. That's Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Once again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.